watching. Oh, I'm on air. And you start the countdown? All right. A warm welcome to a session about user experience benchmarking. It's great to be here, and it's a great honor, and I really appreciate that so many of you show up last day at TechEd, so many great other sessions here, and let's go through this user experience thing in virtual desktops. And you see, this place for the title was a little bit too small, so I had to come up with my own idea. UX and VDI, when is it good enough? My name is Benny Tritch, and I'm an RDS MVP, which used to be Terminal Services. I'm an MVP since 11 years now, so I'm a veteran in this industry. And you will hear about my some of the stuff that I did previously prior to being an MVP in about a minute. And I'm also a CTO at a company called BlueQ Consulting, which is based in Germany. So we're covering the German-speaking market and providing infrastructure services and desktop and deployment, messaging. So these are our core topics that we are covering for our customers in the German-speaking market. Good. What is going to be in this session? First of all, we're going to talk about what is user experience in virtual desktop environments, because there is no real definition for that. And the history behind that I started dealing with that topic is a couple of years ago, there was a great session at a conference called Bri Forum, delivered by Nellie Porter. At the time, she was group program manager of the RDS team, the product team. And she tried to explain how they remote all these different graphics formats using Terminal Services. Now, the thing was, she was speaking in front of IT pros, and she is a developer. Now, there are different, terminologies that IT pros and developers are using. So she tried to explain things in her words, and you were looking in the eyes of all the IT pros, and it was all these question marks. What is she talking about? And so Sean Buss, another MVP, and I, we decided that we want to be the ones who translate this story into the IT pro jargon. And that was the day when the idea of how are we going to do this remote graphics benchmarking and testing. And so when we presented our first session explaining how these different remoting protocols work, or how the different graphics formats work on different remoting protocols, the attendees said, we want to see that stuff. It's extremely hard to bring demo equipment with you that allow you to present different remoting protocols live on stage. So we had to figure out a way. And this session is a lot about how we figured out how to build those test environments and how to find metrics to judge what is good enough and what is not. And that was the toughest part. So as you can imagine, it's a lot of speaking about video load testing and benchmarking, the graphics formats used in virtual desktops, and then finally building the virtual desktop test labs. In the end, I will show you stuff that went wrong, like not in our build process of the environment, more like we ran into issues with some remoting scenarios that we did not expect. And as a matter of fact, the vendors, the manufacturers, they also did not expect that. And our methodology helped us to give them very clear help how to build their reference environment in order to reproduce those things. Now, when I was young and I was in research, at CERN, that was in the late 80s, beginning of the 90s. And this is where I learned how to do those kind of, build those test labs and test environments in a way that is accepted by the research community. And there was another thing at the time, one of those CERN experiments that I was working at, I was part of the OPAL experiment of the LEP of the lab accelerator. And that was 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, that we gathered all these results from this experiment. The thing was, when you did these experiments, you built the accelerator, and then you had a detector sitting at one place. A detector, a room, a chamber for a detector was about the size of this room, but it was higher, and it was about 100 meters deep down under the earth, close to Geneva. And then there was this detector in this room, like 10 meters long, 8 meters wide, and you were shooting particles at each other. There, you had particle on one side that nobody could see, and then particle on the other side that nobody could see, and you tried to collide them, to that they hit each other. This creates results, and the detector is nothing but the camera. You take pictures of that event. Now, that generates a lot of data. At the time, that was gigabyte of data, and we are talking about the end of the 80s. So that was really tough stuff. And if you translate that into something that is more tangible, now imagine there was a spaceship, and that suddenly comes down, and it's an alien spaceship. It lands on Earth, and it has nothing on board but 10,000 cars that look 100% identical. You can get in the car, and you drive with the car, and you find out it's superior technology. And now the scientists kick in, and they decide, we want to find out how this car works. Now, unfortunately, they can't open the hood. They don't know how to unlock that. So what are they going to do? They're going to shoot at the car. The car gets destroyed, and they have canvases. And now you see the debris that goes to the canvases. And they just collect these images of these canvases. And they have other research teams that are building cars and trying to reproduce that car that they're seeing there. And then they're shooting at this reproduced car. And if the pattern looks the same, they found out how the engine works. This is how high energy physics works. This is why from one experiment to the next, it typically takes 20 years. So that is the idea behind that. So it's crazy. We had one event per second that we generated. So one picture per second that we generated over 10 years. That is the amount of data that was generated. And funny enough, you can use those the data sets later. Because if the theoretical physicists find out, oh, our theory that we had at the beginning is not accurate, we think stuff looks a little bit differently. You can go back to the archive data and check if the archive data fits that model. So whenever you read in the newspapers that Stephen Hawking or somebody of those master brains thinks that the theory is a little bit different, all these other physicists go to the archives of all the data they collected over the last 20, 30, 40 years and try to find evidence if the stuff that they recorded at the time fits this new model. So this is the idea. It's a lot about big data, and it's a lot about being very, very precise and reproducible in your lab. So this is exactly what the idea was when we built our lab. Now, as I said, there are different graphics formats. I don't want to go through all these different graphics formats. Just keep in mind, your desktop is composed of these graphics formats. Now, if we do graphics remoting, we have a host, and we run the application and the desktop on that host, and we're using a remoting protocol to connect to this host, and the display happens on the client, and the interaction happens on the client, and all the data that is related to the interaction goes to the host. So that is the idea. The thing is that now you have two window managers. You have one on the host, and you have one on the client side. And you never know which one is the one that is in charge of doing things. Because there are things that allow you to redirect some of the graphics formats or multimedia formats. So, and it doesn't matter if it's remote desktop session host or remote desktop virtualization host. So if it's VDI or terminal services, it's pretty much the same idea. We can do client-side rendering, which means we redirect as much as we can to the client side. So you interact with your desktop, it all goes to the host. The host generates the desktop, but it does not paint it in the frame buffer. Rather, it sends individual data streams representing all the different graphics formats, and the client window manager is in charge of dealing with that. And the other side is, when we do host-side rendering, guess what happens? We interact with the system, everything is generated and painted and rendered on the host side, and then the resulting images or video, it's basically a video that is transmitted in one big channel, in one big stream over to the client. Now you see all these things that are happening on the host side: render, capture, compress, encrypt, and on the client side, decrypt, compress, display. The thing was, for many years we thought that host-side rendering would never be the technology that works best. We always thought that we can do it on clients because we use the client capacity to do that. Unfortunately, development goes so fast regarding all these different multimedia formats and orchestrating user interfaces, transparency, all these color effects that are in there, 3D effects that are in there. Windows Presentation Foundation was a milestone when it comes to that, because that was a real challenge if you do it client-side. And in particular, if you have non-Windows platforms, a non-Windows platform doesn't even know what GDI is. So there are emulators that you can run on a Mac that emulates GDI so that the Mac understands the very old-fashioned Windows API calls. But the better way of dealing with that is doing everything on the host side, because then it's just one format, one stream that the client has to understand. That's all. So this is the future, very clearly. Remote FX, for example, is built on this kind of technology. And now we want to use that in these high-end graphics scenarios, 3D graphics for virtual desktop use cases are out there, and we're talking about all those that are here on the screen. My particular favorites, as you can imagine as a German, is automotive, it's medical. I hear more and more about the high performance computing in different places like banks. I was involved in projects around oil and gas, but that was not in the German speaking market, so this was in markets outside of my home market, so to say. Construction and engineering, there are a couple of use cases that are very interesting that never came to my mind, that companies came to me and said, hey, we want to use high-end 3D graphics for this kind of use case. And it saves them a lot of money if they really do that. So they want to invest the money to save money in the end. But the thing is that we found out when we did our tests that the hardware acceleration of graphics remoting, which we are more and more looking into, is not limited only to CAD/CAM. Applications, but also to web browsers. Office can benefit of that, graphics editors, and all the media players, video editors. And there's a business case for that. And business requirements are data leakage protection. And guess what? I was at GTC, the conference that NVIDIA does in San Jose earlier this year. That was in March. And there was Gulfstream, the company Gulfstream, and they're building airplanes. And their construction site, they show pictures of their construction site where they have, well, two construction lines for the airplanes. And there was a nice picture of that construction site, and then the presenter said, so, and now I want to only highlight all the graphics workstations that we have there. So he dimmed down all the other elements of the picture, and only the graphics workstations would stick out. And so he said, we have more than 200 graphics workstations here, and they're vulnerable. All our data, all our intellectual property has to be on these workstations. So if somebody is able to only break into one of these machines, they can steal all our plans, all our blueprints. So they moved everything into a data center and only allowed those people that work on this construction plant to access through graphics remoting. And that was amazing. I never thought that they would do something like that, but they wanted to protect their data. And if you have distributed workforce, which means that people are working from different places, I will cover that in a little bit, and access to large data sets, meaning if you are far away from your file server, even if you have a high-end machine, it takes a very long time to download large data sets and to start your application, including the models or something that you want to interact with. So if your data center hosts both the application and the data, that's a lot faster because you have better performing networks between those two nodes. And that is significant sometimes for users. Sometimes users prefer that data loads faster than interacting with something that is optimized for the usage in terms of, delay on the screen. The benefits are very clear. I mentioned them. Instead of having local applications, you put them on a server, you put the server in a data center, you have the control, efficiency, the cloudification, and the security. Now add mobility, and we are there. This is the story. This is why Microsoft moved the entire remote desktop and virtual desktop story into enterprise mobility. That's the reason why. Now, coming to performance. How can you evaluate a system? And there are different aspects to evaluating a system, a remoting system. So you have performance, load, stress, endurance, and scalability. Performance is a lot about user experience. If you combine it with load, adding more load to the machines, then your user experience may degrade. What we did in our tests is that we try to find out what is the maximum performance we get from a predefined remoting protocol and a VDI infrastructure. In other words, we were testing how good is RemoteFX with Windows 8.1 on server 2012 R2 if we compare it to Citrix Zen Desktop. So these were the kinds of comparisons we did, but only running one session at the time. So that gave us the baseline. What can the protocol and the VDI infrastructure do? There are other solutions out there, and I will refer to them in a little bit, that rather concentrate on load and scalability. You have to use both. If you only use one, it's not the full story, to be very clear. So I do not only want to promote the stuff that we did in our little team. It was a team of three people doing that. But it is also about referring to the work that other people did. Because the performance criteria are in the traditional world, if you have a local machine, it's very simple. It's frame rates, it's the system performance counters. But then you get the additional criteria, as I mentioned earlier. So what is the perceived user experience? Because there is no performance counter out there that tells you what the perceived user experience is. What are the supported graphics and multimedia formats? The client capabilities, what can the client do? The UI performance degradation when you change the networking conditions, what happens? The compression artifacts you may see, because there are compression algorithms involved, and what happens if media streams are not in sync anymore? If the video plays and somebody is speaking, but the voice, the audio stream is lagging 2 seconds. Very, very annoying, because the human ear is a lot more sensitive than the human eye. The human eye can deal with stuff like, okay, the image is blurred at the beginning and only after like 2 seconds the image is clear. The ear cannot tolerate that. The ear is a lot more sensitive. So if there's only a lag of a couple of milliseconds sometimes, it's very awkward. And it reminds you of people are too far away. So you see people when the audio stream is falling behind the video stream, that they're going closer and closer and closer to the monitor because they want to compensate like they do in real life. Because if the audio takes too long to come to you and it's not in sync anymore, the speaker is too far away, so you try to get closer to the speaker. That is the idea. And suddenly people do that in front of their monitors because this is something that we did since millions of years. So it's very hard to get away from that behavior. And as I said, the relevant network factors, bandwidth, latency, and packet loss. What we found out during the test, bandwidth is not the only relevant factor because we have so many customers that say, oh yeah, performance is bad, so we add bandwidth. And sometimes I say, no, that's not going to help you. just find out, where is the problem? Is it in a subsidiary that is like on another continent? So probably adding bandwidth will not really solve the problem, because you have latency. And if you go through the public internet, you may have packet loss up to 1%, 2%, 5%. So how can the protocol deal with the packet loss? And what is the perceived performance on the user side if you do so? So what we did is we set up a network emulation environment with a couple of standard scenarios representing same continent with a slow communication speed, and then between continents. And so you see that within a continent, we typically refer to 50 milliseconds latency. When we go across continents, it's 200 milliseconds. Sometimes we go up to 300 milliseconds. So you see, if you have 12 megabits, 300 milliseconds, 1% packet loss, typically you would say, hey, 12 megabit, that should really do the job. You will see later, nope, it does not. So this is a very critical factor. Then there are research studies that are talking about what is it, what is user experience? And one of the most important things is response time. How long does it take until a system really responds to user input? And this was published in the 90s. So you see, people started working on that kind of stuff very early, but that was local systems, when the compute power was not good enough to give you a real crisp user experience. People started working on that kind of information. 0.1 second is regarded as the system responds instantaneously. Everybody is happy. 1 second, well, I can see it, I can feel it, but I do not expect the user interface to tell me. It doesn't make any sense to create a progress bar for an activity that only takes 1 second. While 10 seconds at that time seemed to be that, well, the time span from where you expected the user interface to tell you, yeah, I'm still working on that. So that is the idea of that publication. Still relevant, very relevant, as you will see. Because there are newer studies from 2010, and they say, well, the user performance is affected, so you can really see it, starting with 75 milliseconds, so close to this 0.1 second level. Increase of task completion time, that is with 250 milliseconds, a quarter of a second. And when we have 400 milliseconds, the user starts adapting to it. The funny thing with the adaptation of users is, after a while, they don't know anymore that they're adapting to it. When I was still in research, because after I was at CERN, I was in computer graphics research, and we did a lot of research around virtual reality. And when these people were wearing the virtual reality gear for an entire day, they adapted to the delays. So we found out, when you did that for an entire day, you cannot drive with your car anymore. It's impossible. Because when those people took the gear off and they were trying to get out of the room, they ran into the wall because the door was coming too fast. The brain adapts to that. That is really, really interesting. So that takes user experience in a completely different perspective. Did you ever hear about these experiments with prism glasses that they gave basketball players? These prism glasses, what they do is they put the left side on the right side and the right side on the left side. So you put these glasses on and you can't do anything. So they gave these pro basketball players the ball and they asked them, okay, now you do your job. They missed every time. Like after 5, 6, 7 hours, the brain adapted and it put the real picture together again. So they scored again. Now, taking the glasses off, no way to score, because it takes the brain a while to adapt back. And this is something that is a human thing that we have built in. So we can't remove it. There is no brain 2.0 where she can upload in order to replace this behavior. So that brings that stuff into perspective. Very, very interesting when we did these testing. And you will see one of the results very soon. Now, even the U.S. Department of Defense, they came up with their interpretation of the facts. And see, 0.1 second, 0.2, 0.5, 1 second, 10 seconds. These are exactly those limits or the response time definitions that they have. So now we know that they expect the sound click after 0.1 seconds after somebody did that. Clicked something, they want to hear the sound click. If there is an audio feedback. Very interesting. So I thought this was very, very good. Because they came up with it in 99 and they updated this in 2012. So it is a modern sheet here. So try to find that with your preferred search engine. And it's very interesting. It's a like 200 page document including this chart. And as I said, primary device versus secondary device. Do not expect that your users do expect you to provide the same sort of user experience on all the different devices. Now, if you have a designer and you ask the designer on a regular basis, once per week, you go to the construction site. So you are in your design lab, you do all your design work on your high-end graphics workstation, but then we want you to go out and talk to those people who built the stuff that you design. Now, they can't take their workstation with them, so they want to have a mobile device. But when they're on the construction side, they don't want to really design stuff. They want to make annotations. And that is a completely different use case. So what you do on-prem, when you have a direct connection to your high-end workstation, on the other side, you walk out of your office with a mobile device, that may be different. So you have to find out what your users really need. Good. So now I want to show you the first stuff that we found out when doing interactive testing, which is really funny, because that was something that was done by Sean Bass. And we thought that we really want to do some interactive stuff, so we found this very cool application that is called Whack-A-Mole. If you ever were to the U.S. and went to a fair there or something, so that is very popular in the U.S., so they have, this is a physical game typically, so you have a machine and you have this hammer and you whack the mold, you hit the hamster. And that is a flash game. Now, as I said, we recorded those things in order to find out when is the perceived performance good enough. Now we did the same thing with different Windows 7 RDP8 remote effects setups, and you see the only difference is the network bandwidth. So left upper is the LAN, the right upper is 2 megabit 50 milliseconds, lower left is the that is 8 megabit 200 milliseconds, and on the right side it's 12 megabit 200 milliseconds but 1% packet loss. Now you see hardly any difference. Our remote effects is really dealing well with that kind of scenario. So, let's fall back. Where's my mouse? To Windows 7 RDP7. Same setup, same network latencies. Now things get a little bit tougher. In particular, look at the right lower side. I don't know how Sean does that. He kind of predicts where they will be. So his brain already adapted big time. So he's really good at that. And I always try to compete with him on that. Impossible. It's amazing how good he scores without really seeing what's going on. So you see the lag. It really falls behind. So yes, he cannot reach the same scores that he does in a LAN scenario, but this is what your users get when they are at a remote place if you're using the wrong protocol. So this is clearly an indicator. Please move on with the latest Microsoft stuff that they have. Things get even better if you use Windows 8.1 instead of Windows 7. And we did first tests with Windows 10, so they're working on that protocol aspects massively. That is rather interesting, and this is how we find that out, doing that kind of stuff. The funny thing is, if you played that like 200 times and your wife comes into your lab and she asks you, what are you doing? And you say, I'm working. Yeah, she says, I see that. I recorded many videos, so videos, playback scenarios, which I will show later, and that was the same thing. She thought that I'm crazy watching the video over and over and over again. Good. Now, typical scalability test environments, if you want to do such tests, most of the time you need a control node. You need then clients that take access to create load on the backend system. Good. So that means it is hard to set up. What could be the methodology to do that? You can either have the test logic on the client side. Doing test logic on the client side is the natural thing for us human users. It's extremely hard for computers because it requires pattern recognition. Almost impossible. So most test suites with client-side testing require very, very beefy client components. Most of the tests are done on the server side. So you either can have the user AD on the client and then connect to the server, or you have the users even on the backend side and just have a session launcher on the client side. And you record the results into a database. I did that kind of stuff since many years, so that was my first benchmarking results I did together with Fujitsu, trying to put as much load as possible on a machine until it crashed, finding out what is the limit. So I always did it until it crashed. Then I did the same thing when Windows 64-bit was introduced, finding out that you cannot put as many users on 64-bit as you can do on 32-bit if you have not more than 4 gig of RAM. At the time when I did those tests in 2006, RAM was extremely expensive. And I did that kind of presentation at a Microsoft event, and they said, you will never, ever speak at the Microsoft event again because you said that we get less users on 64-bit than we do on 32-bit. I said, yeah, but 4 gig you do. And they said, this is not what we want to hear. This is against what we say in marketing. So I said, oh, sorry about that. So there were like 4 sessions before me that were preaching the value of 64-bit, and then I came with these results. But I said, please reproduce them in your lab, and you will see. Yeah, if we go beyond the 4 gig, we're fine. And today we are. 64 gig is a no-brainer. But at this time, that was different. So it can be very controversial. So I had my test suite doing that, and then later, Microsoft asked me back and do some testing with Office 2003, Office 2007 against, guess what, OpenOffice. At the time, they were kind of scared of OpenOffice and they asked me to do benchmarking to compare those three. They were really happy that, what happened here? It's interesting. They were really happy that Microsoft Office was the winner. But they also did some very great benchmarking very early on. That is a picture from a benchmarking that Microsoft did in their test group, the RDS team. Kostin Hegyu is the one who did that. And he started using the response time of the system to figure out when is it saturated. I waited until the systems crashed. He said, no, this is not the right way of doing it. So why don't you we'll look at the response time, and as soon as it goes beyond a certain threshold, we say that now the system is saturated. Hey, great idea. And guess what? There are people who are doing that. Login VSI. This is the methodology that is behind Login VSI. So even Microsoft is using internally, they are using Login VSI to do the benchmarking. So it is a load and scalability test. So it simulates workloads, scripted in a 48-minute loop, and it will loop on and loop on, and within each loop, they're measuring response times of certain elements, and then take the average baseline response time, it's called the VSI base, and then they add more users to it, and they measure how these things change. And then they decided, and I was part of the initial design team of Login VSI, then they decided that 2,600 milliseconds is this threshold from there on, the system is regarded as not responsive enough anymore. So what they do is, they add users, they do these measurements, and then if it hits this 2,600 milliseconds from the baseline at the beginning, they say, now the system is saturated. And this is the index that they give you. So this is the methodology. And so they were able to find out interesting stuff, because then they put users on standard hypervisors. You see, it's very interesting. These are historic results. Do not use them for today. This is why I did that intentionally. Very old results, but that was the idea. As you can imagine, that generated, interesting reactions from some of the vendors. So if they were not the winners, they were not happy about it. Now they introduced a new methodology. It's a graphics workload. So what they do is they use, as a key performance indicator for higher end graphics, they are using frame rates. And I'm going to talk about frame rates in the next slide, so to say. The thing is that frame rates are great, but as I said, it's not the only factor. But the Login VSI graphics framework is a framework to start with. They want to add more functionality, because today there's nothing else out there that really does that load and scalability benchmarking for graphics load. So the traditional benchmarking tools do not apply here. So this is what it looks like. Again, you see those graphs, but there's no index anymore. And the problem with frame rates is you can create frames or number of frames. You can count them on the sender side. You can count them in the protocol. And you can count them on the output device. Now, how do those frame rate counters do it? And this is the interesting thing. Now, if we look at some of the results that I have here, you will be able to see you have a bare metal on the upper left. I have a bare metal with a high-end graphics card on the upper right. And lower left, it's RDP8, vGPU, so it's remote effects. On the lower right, it is HDX 3D Pro from Citrix. And if we look at the frame rates, they are very different. So if we zoom into them, so you have 6,000 here, you have only 60 here, you have 1,500 there. But if you look at the perceived performance, there's not so much of a difference. And the things even get worse. If we have here a roller coaster ride, now I added some of the network charts, like indicating what is the network bandwidth that is required for that. So you see it's 500 on the left side. It's only 50 or something on the right side. The left one consumes 30 megabit per second to do that. That's remote FX with Windows 7. On the right side, that is HDX, so Citrix. So Citrix is a lot more efficient when it comes to not using too much bandwidth, but it looks like it's not generating enough frames per second. Now let's go move on and now reduce the amount of bandwidth that's available at 50 milliseconds. Now you see, the frame rate still tells us it's 500 frames per second on the left side. Now Microsoft cannot use more than 4 megabit, even if they have 8 megabit available, but the delay, the latency is not suited for the protocol version here, so it cannot take advantage of the full bandwidth. Citrix is dealing a little bit better with it, and their perceived performance is clearly better. So in this case, do not believe what the frame rate tells you. So you need more information. You need to collect all this data. And things get even worse if we go down to let's say a scenario with 8 megabit, 200 milliseconds. So this old Microsoft RemoteFX version falls apart. The newer ones, they work really well, but I wanted to just to show you what these frame rate numbers can tell you and what they cannot. So probably they count on the sender side, but it never makes it to the client. Okay, that gives you an impression about that. But I wanna encourage you, use the Login VSI stuff. It's great stuff. Now, what we did is to do the benchmarking for the baseline is putting our performance lab together. This is the general overview. Looks familiar. You have one controller, you have a client, you have a guest, which is hosted on the host. Wonderful. You collect the data. Okay, how does it look like in reality? We have a WAN emulator, an apposit box. It's an appliance that's between the client and the host. Then we have some backend servers that we need for Active Directory and all that other stuff. We need to install software on the guest systems. So somehow we need to bring our test software to that. We have the lab controller PC, the user experience tracker. The user experience tracker has a frame grabber built in, and this frame grabber allows us to record all these videos without making any influence on the client, because this is what I learned at CERN. If you modify stuff and you experiment too much, it does not reflect reality anymore. So the Heisenberg uncertainty and all that stuff kicks in, not here, but at CERN. Here, if we install software, recording software on the client, it does not represent reality anymore. So we need some extra hardware for that. It goes in the lab controller. The lab controller, it starts all the test sequences. It controls the WAN emulator. It controls the guest systems. And it writes all the data to a hard disk. Until today, we recorded close to 5,000 HD videos that way over the last 5 years, generating 150 gigabyte of data. So this is why I thought I'm back at CERN, collecting data like crazy and not analyzing it in real time. This is impossible. But then having post-processing algorithms that look at these raw videos and do something with it, and looking at the WAN emulator data, because we were also collecting all this data. You've seen the charts showing you what the bandwidth was at the time. So we collect this data within the appliance. It exports a CSV file, and then we can process the CSV file into a chart, into a graphics that we can put into relation with the video. So that gives you the idea what's going on the network, why your user is seeing something. So that is the idea. What does it require to build that system? I will not go through the entire stack of stuff, but we did make sure that we always use the same versions in all the labs that we built. So we have one lab in Frankfurt or Darmstadt and another lab in Chicago, so allowing us to reproduce the results. The thing is that primarily it's Microsoft tools. It's MPEG 4 version 2, it's PowerShell, Silverlight, sysinternal, PSXEC, is expression encoder. So this is the stuff that we're primarily using. In addition to that, we have some codecs that are third party, and we use AutoEd. That's the only thing that is not from Microsoft. The frame grabbers that you can use, that is the most critical piece of equipment. And it took us a long time to figure out which ones are out there in the market. And it gets better now, because now it's a big thing to record gaming and then publish it on the internet. And suddenly you find those devices that were built for that purpose. So when you ask your boss to buy one of those, he may ask you, what are you up to? You want to record while you're playing at work and then publish it on YouTube? Is that what you want? No. You want to really record your user sessions in a VDI environment. This is what it's good for. You can also use a webcam, but a webcam is the less accurate, the least accurate thing. The other thing is the WAN emulators, Apposit or WANEM. Apposit is expensive, to be very clear. If you want to buy those devices, they are not cheap. It's a major investment that you have to do. The Epiphone box or these frame grabbers, they are in the range of 500 to 1,000 euro, so it's not so expensive. But with the Apposit stuff, we're talking about five-digit numbers. So this is a major investment, as I said. Those in bold, these are the ones that I use in my lab, and that's used in the Chicago lab. This is the Epiphone capture tool, so this is how it's configured, using this the right codec and everything, and making sure that it only records 45-second video sequences. This is what we did, always 45 seconds. And we built our own test servers That was also a challenge. How can you install all these VDI infrastructures on the same box? So we built our own servers. We had to find the right mainboard. We had to find the right CPU. We were using a case that houses six SSDs, so that we were able to use six identical SSDs, install the different products on each of the SSDs, and just plug that one in that we wanted to test, because we don't want to reinstall everything when we just want to switch from one vendor to the next. So typically we have six full-blown 1 terabyte SSDs with the latest and greatest installed, which allows us to just plug it in and do and run the tests again. That was also a major investment into the SSDs. And you need a big power supply, because here in this machine there's one K2 from NVIDIA and a K5000 at the same time. So finding a 1,000 watt power supply in the consumer market was not so easy. So it's basically a gaming setup. Also, the case is a gaming case. That works for that kind of test. But if you want to do serious tests, use that equipment. The other thing is only the first step. Here, then you have the enterprise equipment. And please, please, please use only those that are on the compatibility list of those vendors or NVIDIA. We have Dell PowerEdge R720s, which Dell gave us, which we really appreciate. And we had to make sure that the BIOS is set accordingly, that everything works. Because if the BIOS requirements are not met, the GPUs will die. The VMs connected to the physical GPUs, they will just die. They will blue screen or just not start. So if you invested into the wrong hardware, you're stuck. Basically, you're stuck. You can't get away from that. So, now, the test applications is the next step. So what test applications to use? Here is the stuff that we are using. Here is, a list of the most popular graphics benchmarks that are out there in the market. There's one important thing you need to know. You cannot just use those and run your tests and then publish it. Some of them do not allow you to do that, like 3DMark, by FutureMark, there are different editions. So we had to buy the Pro edition, which cost $1,000, which allows you to publish your results. So this is why I can play back those videos I recorded with 3DMark, and only because of that. If you buy the low-cost edition at $50, you can use it for yourself, but you cannot speak in public about it. So that's a deal. Make sure that you do not violate any of those copyrights and stuff like that. Now, we install everything on the host, on the VM, on the host. So we have an auto-install script that does that all. And I want to show you the audio install script in a little. So we configure the firewall, the perflog, PSXX, and all these little test applications that we need. And then we have a collection of test scenarios that we can write. Always check the rights to use these test applications. We had to learn it the real hard way, I tell you. So if you're using some video trailers of popular movies, even if it's trailers, you can't do that. So TechEd in Houston, Microsoft was very clear about some of the videos that we wanted to present, that this is not possible. Otherwise, Microsoft would get sued for that. And that would be very expensive. Good. Now let's dig into some of these videos and then show you how the real setup of that environment looks like. So, let's look at some artifacts. What happens? We have a very early test where we see some really nice artifacts, compression artifacts. This is in here. So, you see, after a while, the compression algorithm kind of distracts. You see all these block building stuff? And sometimes it continues working, but you see that artifacts here, and it makes it unusable very clearly. But that was recorded a long time ago. And you see 2 megabit, 50 milliseconds, 2% packet loss So the packet loss was really painful for that particular version of the protocol. That was Windows 8 RDP 8. Even though it's relatively new, packet loss is really tough. So, zooming out again. Take the next one. Here it's a color. That was a funny thing that we found out. Because we were using Fishbowl, a fairly standard HTML5 application. Look at that. And we reported that back to Microsoft. And we asked them, hey, what happened there? And they said, this cannot happen, because this is Microsoft technology on the protocol side, and it's a Microsoft technology on the test application side. I said, here is the setup. Please reproduce it in your lab. And they did. And they said, there must have been a shock in the water. So that was their response. And then we asked again, OK, come on, guys, get serious. What is it? A bug in the color lookup table for rendering HTML5, in particular if you were using non-Windows, non-Microsoft browsers. So that was the thing. So, but it took us a while. And you will see that demo in a bit again, because it's good for something else that I want to show you. Here with the performance, you've seen that before. So you see the degradation in performance, or the improvement in performance. You see here soft GPU, Windows 8. You see remote FX on Windows 7, remote FX on Windows 8, remote FX on Windows 10. Technology preview. So the lower left, lower right is Windows 10 technology preview. Do not really trust the frame rates again, as I said earlier. But you see, they already work massively on that algorithm. And it really looks good. I mean, it easily is as good as the shipping product now in beta. At a very early beta stage, they are able to really compete with their own shipping product, which is great news, because it still includes a lot of debug code. Here we have an interesting application that no matter what we do on the network, the performance is not degraded. It's again an HTML5 application. And step by step, you will see it builds. But even if you have 8 megabit and 200 milliseconds on the lower right side, performance is still really good if you compare it to the upper left, which is in a LAN scenario. So that was very, very impressive. However, we also have a DX9 application where you can see the degradation. So again, upper left, that is LAN. And then on the lower side, you add more and more, you constrain the network more and more. 2 megabit, 50 milliseconds. Not really usable. So it's exactly the same thing that we did before with the HTML5 app, and it worked fine. And now we are using a DX9, and it falls apart. OK. So this is what you have to learn. Know your applications, and know the requirements that your users have. So without that, if your users are happy with 2 frames per second for that particular application because they only want to click on it and get some notification, that's fine. Sometimes users are like that. Find that out before you implement that. Bandwidth is very interesting. We have here a nice little flash application running it on Windows 7, I think. Yeah, Windows 7, RDP 7.1 on the left, RDP 8 on the right. Hey, RDP takes all it can get. So we're talking about 80 megabit per second. Here, we did not use the data that we extracted from the apposite box. Here, we were using the display on the lab controller. So we were just looking at the web interface of the apposite box. And in the end, we took a screenshot. And then we extracted that information from the screenshot. We stopped doing that because we want to have real raw data and not a screenshot of that. But that was the first iteration of what we did. But you see, it's a little bit better on the right side, but it still uses a lot of bandwidth. Now compare that to something that does flash redirection. We're talking about a couple of kilobits per second compared to 80 megabits on the other side, but performance is a lot better. Here we do a flash redirection to the client. This is the impact on your network that such a technology can have. Keep that in mind, please. It's not only about the perceived performance you get with one user session, and it's not about the perceived performance that you get when you add more load to your servers. Please also look at your network. I mean, this is a huge difference. These are magnitudes. The other thing that we did is using PowerPoint to see how good can we accelerate PowerPoint on a GPU accelerated system. So this is the standard thing that we see. Now, what is more interesting is how much GPU resources are being consumed by this particular use case. And you see here, it's never using more than 2 or 3% of the GPU. So this is just looking at the GPU, GPU usage and the memory and all that kind of stuff. You see in the background, it's running exactly the same thing. It never goes beyond, 4%, 5%. It's always between 2 and 5%. So this is what we learned with this scenario. Now we have another one, and you've seen that before. This is this red engine turbine. That's that one here. That's a nice demo. And again, we want to know what is the impact on the GPU if we do that. And the story is very, very different. So now we are talking about 25, 30, 33% that is consumed only by this particular application. Now you can imagine if you cramp more users on your system, even if it's GPU accelerated, it will degrade the user experience massively. On the other side, hey, we can even accelerate PowerPoint by using a GPU. That is the good news. So now I want to really show you how this demo environment works. And for that, I built a little environment that simulates my lab infrastructure. What I have here is I have a domain controller that's running here on my client Hyper-V. I have a domain joint client running Windows 8.1. And I have a Windows 8 VM with my test software installed. So I'm using this little tool here, Sense Connector, in order to have access to all these VMs. Now, if I go to the VM that I use that simulates my client machine. At home I have a physical shuttle machine, a bare bone machine that is my client for the testing. And this is sort of simulated by this VM. And now I remote into the VM under test. So if we go back to the overview, I'm using this one here in the middle to remote into that one on the right side. So I do not open an interactive window here, but what I did is I already logged into this machine. Now on this machine, you see, there is a folder called Delmi and there's a folder called Auto Install. Now if I check what is the size of this folder, it's massive, 3.8 gigabytes. So this is the test software that is in the install folder. And in this install folder, I have an installation routine. It's nothing more than a CMD file that installs all those. So fairly simple. So if we want to edit that. So I just call the individual install routines to install all these applications. That's it. It takes roughly half hour to install everything on that test machine, and then we are good to go. The only thing that we need then is this Delmi folder, because the Delmi folder includes all the data that we want to use and all the little other things that are required, in particular, AutoIt scripts. I'm going to show you one of these AutoIt scripts. It automates the execution of the test software in this test client, and we always do it in the same way, no matter if it is a terminal server session or if it is a VDI client. It's always the same methodology. So we're running that. Why are we using AutoIt? Because AutoIt has a very low footprint when it comes to execution resources in terms of CPU. It requires only very small CPU resources, like 2 or 3%, which are acceptable. Because we modify the result by doing that in that client, and we try to keep that footprint as small as possible. So this is how that runs. Now, how do we control it? Here is another script, and this other script that calls the individual AutoIt scripts. So it is very indirect. So obviously I have AutoIt scripts that automate my individual tests, and then I have a master script that allows me with parameters to run each of these individual scripts. And from the other side, from the controller PC, which is simulated by my local machine, I have a script that sort of connects to the test machine and launches that particular master control script in the client. But it does a lot more. It checks if there is the right video encoder, the codec installed. Here, in this case, we are not recording the video, so it's commented out. The other thing that it does is it opens a form, an interactive form, allowing me to input some of the data. I will run that in a little bit. And then it runs the AutoIt script on the target VM. Typically, I initiate also the collecting of the data at the WAN emulator. I commented that out. We still have the code in here that was used to do the screenshot of the Apposite web front end. And you see here the Netropy stuff. So we're SSHing into the Netropy box and get all the data, and that is it. Good. Now, if I really want to run that, what does that look like? Well, let's close that, because we're going to control this machine here. Now, I go to my shell. I say DL run test. So this is my lab controller. I press enter. Now it asks me for information about what I'm going to do. So like the IP address, the username, the password in order to run it. And it allows me to select which tests I want to run from my selection of tests. I want to run the SD video test. I'll go back here. It asks me for more stuff, like where do you want to output the data? And I say, OK, this is the moment when it connects to my machine the first time using PSExec. It says, is this the session you want to use? Yes, on this machine, there's only one session. On the terminal server, there could be hundreds of sessions. I select the right one. And now watch the other window in the background, what's going to happen. Because if I say, OK, it launches my test. And this is also the moment when this script would start the video recording in order to collect all this data as a video, as a high definition, 60 frames per second HD video. This is the stuff that I need for the future, because as soon as I find out that changes have been made to a new protocol, I can run these two videos side by side and compare visually what was going on. What we have in mind, what we want to do in the future, is analyze the frames, like frame number 20 in each of these videos, through algorithms to find out, okay, what are the artifacts in there? So it's pure computer graphics that is applied then. So right now, we do it visually. In the future, the idea is to automate that and find out, okay, we have these two results. We synchronize the start time of the video so that they are frame synced. And then we compare what the results are like. Do we see any delays? Do we see any artifacts? What is going on? And give that thing an index or a result. But this is not implemented yet. And we were talking to folks like NVIDIA, because they are doing this high-end computer graphics stuff on their graphics cards. And they say, yeah, we have that kind of algorithms, but they're used for completely different things. So there's this brand new doing this for remoting. This is very interesting. So I worked in research for almost 10 years in computer graphics research. And actually, I have a PhD in graphics remoting, but that is from 96. And now almost 20 years later, we are getting back and trying to find out the quality of remoted graphics through computer graphics algorithms. For me, this is very exciting times. I had to wait for a very long time until this happened. So you see, this is the kind of test runs we're doing here. And it took us a while to put this script framework together, but it gives you an idea how all these things work. And I will give you my email address that is in here so that you can get in touch with me if you want to learn more about the tools that we're using. And I'm writing a series of blog articles talking about those tools. Like the first thing that I'm talking about in a blog article is the Sense Connector, the remote connection manager I'm using. And I will also be writing articles about how to set up the test machines and how to create those PowerShell scripts and all that kind of stuff. It's going to take a while because it took us 5 years to build it, and now documentation was not always in our minds. The post-processing of the videos, what we do is we record the videos in 1280 by 1024 today, and then we use Microsoft Expression Encoder to re-encode the videos. The reason is some of these videos are like 200, 300, 400 megabyte for only 45 seconds. And so we have to make sure that the videos all have roughly the same bit rate or size, because if you play back four of them simultaneously, it would not be fair if one video is 400 megabyte and the other is only like 50. So we have to sort of equalize the size of the video files. So we do a re-encoding to a fixed bit rate and have to be very careful not to introduce any artifacts by doing this re-encoding. So this is why we still store the raw videos, because if we do something wrong during the conversion, we can still fall back to the original raw videos. And then we put it in this 4UP player. This is a Silverlight player that was developed by a development group in Hungary. So that's a great thing that there's a developer who was so friendly to develop the 4UP player for Sean and me. Here is how we do the re-encoding, Microsoft Expression Encoder. Who has ever used that tool? Wow, 1, 2, 3, yeah, you work for Microsoft. Yeah, no? Okay. So it was not very popular. Today you can download it for free, which is great because I'm using it for that kind of conversion. It works nicely for that. And then the split screen video display is powered by Silverlight. So it's again a Microsoft technology. And as promised, I want to, at the end, walk you through a couple of things that went wrong. And let's go back here. So first of all, we have this flash demo with Intel. And that's a very interesting demo, because you can see from the size of the videos, it's a very early version that was recorded in 2011. And it does not look very spectacular because it's a flash thing. So 2 megabit, 50 milliseconds on the upper left. And then we do 200 milliseconds in the other videos. And you see, there's a huge difference. Now, the question I have for you, did you know about the latency hint? Nobody does. Sean Bass and I, we did a presentation in 2011 at Bri Forum, and just before we did the presentation, Nellie Porter, who was group program manager at the time for the RDS team, she came to us and said, hey, did you think about presenting the latency hint? And we were like, the what? The latency hint. I will show you what the latency hint is. You all know remote desktop connection. Now, if you go here, can you see what I'm talking about? Satellite, 2 megabit to 16 megabit per second with high latency. And there's another one with high latency. Their idea at the time was, it was in the, as I said, 2011. They said, hey, if users know that there are at a remote place with high latency, they go to the RDP client and they modify the setting accordingly. And Sean and I, we were like, what? We're RDS MVPs and we didn't know about that. And you expect your users, our users, to do that? Really? And she said, yeah, we invested heavily into the algorithms. They are great. And we said, okay, we're going to give it a try. We test it out. And as a matter of fact, these algorithms were great. But we told them, guys, please, make it an auto-detect thing. So they introduced this one here, detect connection quality automatically later. So this is a newer RDP client. The earlier ones don't have that option. So they were smart enough to take the burden away from the users because the users would never be able to figure that out to get the benefits of what they've done. As I said, they've done a great job. If you continue to play this video without the latency hint on the upper right, the thing doesn't even start with the latency hint. Wow, the 200 milliseconds performance is almost as good as the 50 millisecond performance without the latency hint. So they did a great job, but they did not tell anybody. So that was one of the funny things that we found out doing that kind of tests. The fishbowl, I told you before, that was really, really interesting. That was the one that we tried first. So we saw, on the LAN with Windows 8, RDP 8, great performance. Windows 7, RDP 7.1, ooh, there is again the blood in the water. And to make it even worse, the fishbowl thing showed another very interesting effect. Because depending on the protocol you were using, they tried to compensate for, well, performance lack in different ways. Because, and I did that as expression dancing in one of the shows, because one of the solutions is doing it like having very jaggy stuff like in the upper right, while the other thing was like, oh, we slow it down big time, so well, we are going to do it like that in slow-mo. When we did that for this Xbox game trailer, that was really funny because in some scenarios this warrior would get to the planet and save the Earth really fast, while the other didn't even make it to the door until we were destroyed. That was really, really interesting to find those effects out there, so that some things were happening in slow-mo. When your users say things are getting really slow, sometimes they are right because the algorithms, they try to slow down things in order to catch up or keep up. So that's one thing that is interesting. And we had another nice thing. Like, okay, let's do some HTML5. Here's again this Xbox trailer. Everything looks good. Everything looks good. And you see, it's a Citrix early implementation. So taking the window and just moving it around a little bit. Watch out, watch out. The warrior comes out. Oh, it crashes the browser. Isn't it amazing? We had other ones where when we were playing around with that, it just stopped. It did not continue. The frame just froze and it never recovered. So those were the early bugs that we were seeing here and sending it back to Citrix this time. And there's another one that we sent back to Citrix. And when I said, hey, start time is also something that is important. I mean, the demo already runs. If you look down here, it's exactly the kind of demos that I showed you in my little environment. So you see, do a fast forward, nothing happens until exactly after 30 seconds the video starts that we wanted to start. So if the user says, I double click and it takes ages until stuff starts, with the other scenarios, with the other protocols, that was no problem. This video started immediately. So if we run them side by side for 30 seconds in that one video, in one quadrant, nothing happens. We reported that back to Citrix. They said, no, this is impossible. And again, we said, reproduce it. They reproduced it. They said, yep, it happens. And we have no clue why. So our engineering team is working on it. So it's obviously bugs that we find when we're running these tests. And the final one that I want to show you is an OpenGL application. And When it's reported that the application runs, that is perfect because we expect it to run that way. Now, what we recorded was that. Yes, it kind of runs, but not in a way we expect it to run. So you can't do nothing with that. Now, imagine you have a CAD CAM designer and you give him access to his OpenGL application and it behaves like that. That is a big problem. Please find that out. And no algorithm can find that out by itself. You have to look at it. Run those tests and use your own brain to look at that. Record videos. The thing is, videos are CEO compatible. Because running video side by side and telling your CEO, hey, look, or CFO, if we invest that kind of money, we're going to get that user experience. If we invest that kind of money, this is what we get. Your decision. So you're out of the game. You tell them, this is what we found out, POC, very simple. Set up a test lab, record the videos, show the videos, because videos, 45-second videos, that is something that everybody understands. I mean, you walk out here and you have a certain expertise and expectation now about remoting protocols just by watching a couple of videos. The trick is, how do I build an environment that generates those videos? And, to wrap it up, critical is, what are the graphics formats that are supported? Because if the graphics format is not supported by one of the protocols, what happens is you get an error message. It's pretty much like if you start an OpenGL application and your graphics card is not OpenGL capable, you get the error message, this is not supported here. Now, if you have an OpenGL capable graphics card in your server, but the protocol does not support OpenGL, you get the error message, no matter what your graphics card can do. So this is why it's important to know that Microsoft now with Windows 10 and Server 10 Technology Preview supports OpenGL, which is the big news here. We are very excited about that, that finally Microsoft supports that. And the other thing is, there is only a small number of unbiased acceptance criteria. Yeah, supported formats, delay until application starts, time to load a document, response time when interacting, application UI and client refresh behavior, and the lip sync thing. We did not record any lip sync related stuff. Okay, this is the team that did it. Ruben Sprout was here in the session yesterday. Sean Bass, he's in the US right now. So he's from Chicago. And if you want to get more information about that, please shoot me an email. Just send me to this email address, subject UX in VDI. What I will send you is the white paper that we created about, I'm going to go back so that you can take pictures. No problem with that. You will get the white paper that we created. It's a hard copy that we have, but we also have it as PDF. And all the other things that we will be working on in this Team RGE, we will inform you about that, because we are very excited about now that Microsoft thought it's a good idea to bring that to TechEd, because I did never expect that they want to have a session like that here at TechEd. But it seems to be something that is also interesting for Microsoft, finding out what is the expected or the perceived user experience. Probably looking forward to something that we see from Azure, because today we have remote app from Azure and we have RDSH from Azure. We will see what the future will bring. So, what are the lessons learned? Only a few common criteria. The response time thing is still very important. User expectance depends on the use case. Primary device and secondary device requirements, keep this in mind, and test environments, they do not represent real life. It's only for the expectation management. Please, please, please keep that in mind. That is very important. With that, thank you very much. And please do not forget to, where is that? To complete the evaluation, to make us these things even better. Thank you very much. But we're still here if you have questions.